This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Is The People Speak on BBS Radio.
The winner of the $75,000 2012 Gordon E. Moore Award in the category of Medicine and Health Sciences.
Hello and welcome to the show. I am Samantha Legend. We have a very special guest today. In 2012, Jack Andrega, at age 15, won the prestigious Intel ISEF Gordon E. Moore Award for his invention of a paper sensor strip that detects pancreatic, lung, and ovarian cancer in its early stages. According to cancer.org, there are 38,460 deaths from pancreatic cancer, 14,230 deaths from ovarian cancer, and a whopping 159,480 deaths from lung cancer. And these are all expected in the U.S. alone. With Jack's new invention, one can test for these various diseases in their earliest stages for pennies, which can result in better diagnosis and treatment, which will increase the survival rate. Currently, he is pursuing a highly esteemed X Prize, and he's here today to tell us about it. Thanks. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Thanks so much for having me.
For those who do not know what the X Prize is, can you please explain what it is and what your submission is?
Yeah, so the X Prize are these very large initiatives that are multi-million dollars, and they're to kind of revolutionize the world and particularly medical science, in my case, through competition. So you essentially have just a bunch of teams compete for this one big award. And so I'm currently pursuing two different X Prizes, the Tricorder X Prize with a team of all high school students from around the world, and that's a $10 million prize to develop something the size of a smartphone that can detect any disease instantly. And then on my own, I'm participating in one that's called the Nokia Biosensing X Prize, which is a $2.25 million prize to revolutionize medical sensors.
It's amazing what you're going to be doing. What was it that I was hearing about the Ramon spectrograph that you're going to try to put into the size of a sugar cube?
So that was one of my past projects, and I was thinking of using that for the Tricorder X Prize. However, now I've turned to a different strategy.
Oh, okay. Let's see. So how exciting was it to have Obama talking and about your initial invention and pointing you out in a news conference? You must have been nervous. Was it completely surreal?
It was really amazing. And because it was the White House Science Fair, I love those types of events because it's a bunch of kids that are my age, and luckily they were all my friends. And so it was just really cool to be there in front of all of your friends and just get called out by the president. It was really amazing.
So where do you keep all your awards? Have you had to rent a storage unit yet?
No, not yet, but they're piling up pretty quickly. But I just think it's really cool that I can have all these experiences as such a young kid.
Absolutely. Do you think you've made the science more appealing to teens in your generation?
Just looking at my school, I really see that science has kind of transformed from this really dry and dull subject into a really exciting possibility, because when you see your classmate win the world's largest science fair, you think, hey, why can't I do this? And so we've seen a surge in science fair participation and interest in science at my school. So hopefully, yes.
So what age were you when you got into science? And are you seeing, you said you're already seeing your peers inspired by the work and results. So, what age were you?
So I first became interested in science when I was 3. My parents got me really interested just through these really easy rudimentary science experiments like Coke and Mentos or like how many books like a bunch of eggshells can carry. And it was these really cool experiments that taught me basic scientific methodology and the empirical method of going through things with the scientific method. And I think that's what has really helped me get through these last few years is that my parents have just really served as great role models for me.
So the Coke and Mentos is kind of the introduction for any 3-year-old. If you want them to be a scientist, do the Coke and Mentos and watch it explode and their eyes
I mean,
go
it's
in
a really
awe.
cool experiment and it captivates them.
Absolutely. It captivated me as an adult. Okay. Let's see. What made you pursue this path in finding out how to test pancreatic cancer?
So I really got interested in pancreatic cancer because a close family friend who's like an uncle to me actually passed away from the disease when I was 13. And when that happened, I found that 85% of all pancreatic cancers are diagnosed late, when some has less than a 2% chance of survival. And that the reason for this is that currently we haven't updated our sensor in over 6 decades, and that misses 30% of all pancreatic cancers and costs $800 per test. And so your doctor has to be ridiculously suspicious that you have the cancer, and thus it's rarely ordered.
How far away is your product from being released to the market for those who need it?
So my product is at least 5 to 10 years away from making it on the shelf or being used in a doctor's office, simply because of clinical trials and all the regulations. And also, we need to do additional testing to make sure that will definitively work.
Are you selling your patent to the pharmaceutical companies? And what assurance do you have that the price will not be raised for those who need it?
So currently, I'm in talks with several large biotech companies, and hopefully, these talks they're going really well so far. And essentially, what I'm going to do is I'm going to write into the contract that the price can't be set over a certain margin.
Oh, so you're going to have a stipulation in there.
Yeah,
Excellent, excellent.
hopefully. So.
So, what would actually prevent it from actually being sold over the counter, say at Walgreens, CVS?
I mean, really, right now, it's just that we have to do additional testing and get through clinical trials. That's the main barrier to market right now.
Okay. You're always speaking to adults. Do you ever have time to be with kids your own age?
Yeah, I always have time to be kids of my own age. I actually go to the movies a lot. I went to the movie actually just yesterday. So, I mean, I love hanging out with kids my own age. I mean, that's why I love going to like TEDx youth events and stuff.
You seem like you're handling fame very well. At least it seems so.
I mean, really for me, it isn't about like the fame or like money. It's more about changing as many lives as possible. I mean, you can win as many awards as you want, but what really matters is the science and how many lives you help.
So, have you been approached by college scouts, and which school are you leaning towards?
So I've been talked to by a lot of the top universities and colleges, but I really have no clue where I want to go. I mean, I just took my SATs and I just have no clue.
Has Harvard or Oxford or
Who knows?
Yale been knocking at the door?
I
I don't know.
mean, just a lot of the, it's just really cool to have all these top colleges looking at me and like asking for me to go. So, but you never know where you'll end up.
So, is it true that you changed your mother's kitchen into a chemistry lab?
So for one, or actually for 2 years, our kitchen became first. It was a bacteria incubation place.
Oh
So I was actually culturing bioluminescent bacteria to detect different water contaminants, and then I would actually do it on the stovetop using the stove to sterilize my inoculation loop. And then also, me and my brother cooked up some high-grade explosives there. So,
Oh, high-grade explosives? What? Tell me more.
so essentially, what happened is we. Well, I'm not sure if I can talk about this actually.
Oh,
Without getting in trouble.
okay. Well, we don't want you in trouble. Okay. So, let's see. Did you ever have one of those experiment kids when you were a kid? You know, those little,
Experiment kids?
yeah, kits, these little kits
Yes.
that you buy with a little microscope so you can look under the lenses, or these chemistry kits.
No,
No,
I never had one
straight
of
for adult lab, right?
those. Yeah, I
Yeah.
just really
Well.
tried doing my own science. I don't know. I never had any of those kits.
I did. I was hoping to be vindicated. Okay. When you were doing your experiments, did you realize the importance and understand the crucial need for your product?
I mean, what really helped me go throughout the entire process, like when I was having a bad day in the lab, was that 100 people die of pancreatic cancer every day, and I think, how am I going to help save 100 lives today? And so that's what really pushed me, and I was just always thinking of the patient when I was doing my research.
Okay, so what inspired you to use carbon nanotubes?
So I actually became interested in carbon nanotubes because on my past project, I'd been investigating the ecotoxicity of various nanomaterials on different aquatic species. And then I was looking at all these nanomaterials and I stumbled across carbon nanotube and I was looking at their properties and they'd just begun to be understood. And I thought, these are really cool. So I was just reading an article on them and in my biology class, and that's actually when I came up with the idea.
Oh, is that when you got in trouble for your creative loafing?
Yes. Yeah. My biology teacher took away the article, but I still had had my idea already.
How did you discover mesothelin?
So essentially what happened is I actually discovered a database of over 8,000 different proteins while I was looking at how we are currently diagnosing pancreatic cancer. And how we do it is we look at your bloodstream and we look for these variations in these protein levels. And while this sounds really straightforward, it's anything but, because essentially you have liters and liters of blood and it's already abundant in all of these proteins, and you're looking for this tiny difference in this tiny amount of protein. So it's next to impossible. It's like trying to find a needle in a stack of nearly identical needles. And so, undeterred, I went back and I found this database of over 8,000 proteins. And I decided, well, I have nothing else to do, so I went through every single one of those proteins on my summer break. And on the 4,000th try, I found one protein called mesothelin that could work for the detection of early pancreatic cancer. And mesothelin is just your ordinary run-of-the-mill type protein, unless you have pancreatic, ovarian, and lung cancer, in which case it's found at these very high levels in your bloodstream. But the key is that it's found in the earliest stages, when something has close to 100% chance of survival. So now that I had found a protein that could potentially signify the presence of the cancer, I then shifted my focus to actually detecting that protein and thus the cancer.
Tell me about your biology class and where you had the idea.
So I actually had this one epiphany moment that made everything come together on this journey. It actually happened in my 8th grade biology class. I was taking high school biology at the time, and I was just sitting there and I'd smuggled in an article on what are called single-walled carbon nanotubes. And these are long, thin tubes of carbon that are an atom thick and they're 1/50,000th the diameter of your hair. So they're extremely, extremely small, but they have these amazing properties. They're kind of like the superheroes of material science. So I was reading about all of these properties and they'd just been discovered, so it was really exciting. And then we were supposed to be learning about these things called antibodies. And my biology teacher was droning on about them. And these are molecules that only react with one specific protein. In this case, it would be that cancer biomarker that I'd found out about, mesothelin. And I was just sitting there, and all of a sudden it hit me. You see, you can combine these two concepts such that you have a network of nanotubes that will only react with one protein. But also, due to the properties of these nanotubes, the network will actually change its electrical conductivity based on the amount of protein present and thus indicate the presence of pancreatic cancer. However, there is one catch with this, is that these networks of nanotubes, they're extremely flimsy. And since they're so delicate, they need to be supported. So I chose to use paper. And making a paper sensor for pancreatic cancer is about as simple as making chocolate chip cookies, which I love. I mean, whenever I do bad on a test, I go for the chocolate chip cookies or ice cream, depending on how bad I did. And so I was reading about, and what happens is, So what happens is you start with some water, you pour in some nanotubes, add some antibodies, take some, Start with some water, you take some antibodies, pour those in, pour in some nanotubes, stir it up, take some paper, dip it, dry it, and then you can detect cancer. So that's how you make my sensor.
Voila. Okay. How did you find a mentor in a lab?
So it's actually this really roundabout way that I found a mentor. I knew that I was going to need a lab. You see, I had done a lot of crazy stuff with my brother in my kitchen and in the garage and downstairs. And essentially, like, we've cooked up like E. coli and cholera where we make our sandwiches. Luckily, we didn't have an outbreak. And then we've also had uranium and we've made explosives. So it's crazy, but I was going to need a lab for cancer research. My mom wasn't going to be supporting that. So I had to essentially email 200 different professors at Johns Hopkins University and the National Institutes of Health. I attached to this email a 32-page behemoth of a document outlining my procedure and budget, materials, timeline, all of that. I emailed it out to all these professors, pretty much anyone who had anything to do with pancreatic cancer, and I actually got 199 rejections from these professors. And I found out that a lot of professors aren't nearly as nice as their profile pictures make them seem.
Ouch.
And some of them actually went through each and every line of my entire procedure saying why it was each step was completely wrong. I have no clue where they got the time, but they did. And eventually I got one positive email from Dr. Anirban Mayucha of Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. I go in for this big interview, and I was expecting a really easy interview, but he actually knew his stuff. He had an MD and like specialized on pancreatic cancer. I couldn't bamboozle him like my parents. So I go in and I just get grilled by him and his PhD students for about an hour. I kind of stumble out of the interview, but at least I knew that I got the lab space I needed. And so then I could start in the lab, and 7 months later, I ended up with one small paper sensor that costs 3 cents and takes 5 minutes to run.
So you didn't give up at all through all these, you know, 200 places. That's can be commended just for, you know, being able to continue on all that rejection. So what are the challenges that you faced when you were in the lab?
Well, I mean, I'd never been in a professional lab before. So there's quite a steep learning curve to overcome. So the first day I actually ended up sneezing in my cell culture, and I thought, oh, cancer, they're hard to kill. They'll get over it. And no, they all died. And so I had to start anew. And then I just promptly like cooked them in the incubator, like froze them, or like I accidentally dropped the flask. And then when I got all the cell culture I needed, I then blew it up in some giant like explosion in the centrifuge. So it was quite an ordeal. And then I had
How big was this explosion?
Let's just say the centrifuge and some of the lab was covered in cell media. And I had to spend the rest of the day cleaning up the lab.
Oh,
but eventually what happened is I got this one procedure that's called the Western blot. And you see, I had to optimize a lot of the different parameters of my sensor to make sure it would work as well, like as good as possible. And so what happened is you run the Western blot to optimize your antibody to make sure it's working, because you want to only react to that one protein. Because if it reacts to another protein, you're just going to get a lot of false positives or false negatives, and it's going to be really bad. So what I did is you have to – the Western blot is more of an art rather than a science. You have to get these really thin, defined bands at certain places, and mine would be like completely black or completely blank or all blurred. So it was quite an ordeal. That was actually the majority of my research time I spent on the Western blot. And then I had to optimize all my other parameters, and I had to get my sensor working. And so it was really challenging, but what really kept me going is that 100 people die of pancreatic cancer every single day. And so I think, how am I going to help save 100 lives today? And I wasn't going to let some silly science procedure tell me that I couldn't do it. So eventually I got through it. I was able to find this new way to detect pancreatic cancer.
So, let's see. How will the sensor impact the medical field?
So this sensor is really exciting its potential. I mean, just in pancreatic cancer, it's the potential to just make the survival rates just skyrocket. But besides that, also has applications in ovarian and lung cancer. And the coolest thing is that you can actually take out that antibody, and that's about as simple as switching out like chocolate chip for butterscotch chips or raisins in a cookie recipe. You just switch it out, and you can detect an entirely different protein, meaning an entirely different disease. And so that means anything ranging from like Alzheimer's to other forms of cancer, even HIV, AIDS, and heart disease. The possibilities are literally endless, and it could have applications in chemotherapy, telling you whether or not your drug regimen is working. It's just really exciting, the potential of the sensor.
That is huge potential. I didn't realize it was so outreaching.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about the open access project you're working on?
Yeah, so what essentially is happening is I'm working with the Right to Research Coalition and Spark to push through this bill in Congress that's called the Fair Access to Scientific and Technology Research Act, or FASTR. And what happens is it would open all the scientific journals to the people. And it's one of the major problems that we face in today's society, particularly as a young scientist. There's these things called paywalls, and essentially you have to pay $35 in order to get access to an article. And because of these inhibitive costs, I had a really hard time accessing a lot of the journals that I needed to do my background research. And that made doing research exponentially more expensive. And a lot of kids don't have the resources to buy all those papers. And we've kind of engineered this fundamental barrier between the youth and science, not only because of our kind of condescending attitude towards youth, but also the fact that we have this giant cost of entry to get into science. I mean, what kid has $35 to spend on a science article when a Katy Perry single costs 99 cents and a seminal science article costs $35? And we're saying, kids, be interested in science. That's a really mixed message we're sending right there. So we definitely need to bring down that cost or just abolish paywalls in general. And not only that, this isn't just a problem for young scientists. This is a problem for pretty much all scientists, because recently Harvard University released a statement saying, we just don't have enough money to buy to continue our subscriptions. And that could potentially curtail a lot of their life-saving research. And so by inhibiting scientific research with these paywalls, we could potentially be not saving as many lives as possible.
It's hard to imagine that even Harvard is having a problem with open access.
Yeah, I mean, when the richest academic institution in the world can't afford to continue paying for its subscriptions, what does that say about the world of academic publishing, accessibility of knowledge, and flow of scientific information? When they can't afford it, how can you expect burgeoning young scientists to get into it? And by instituting these paywalls, we really created this kind of social stratification in terms of science. And what happens is we have the knowledge elite, those universities and corporate laboratories that have access to all the scientific journals we need. But then even there's a stratification there. You see, we have like the really rich universities like the Harvards, Yales, and Stanfords of the world. But then we have, like, for example, local community colleges or state universities, and they just simply don't have as much money or as large of an endowment as those universities. And so it's like saying the top 10 universities, they can teach to calculus, whilst all the other universities, they're relegated to only algebra. And then there's a knowledge middle class, people like you or me. We have access to the internet, and we can look at these articles and the abstracts and the few articles that are open access. But then there's the knowledge underclass, those 80% of the world, the 5.5 billion people who don't even have access to the internet. And so they don't have access to any of the modern knowledge whatsoever. And that's a huge problem. We're just throwing away so much human capital right there. And so in my opinion, we are living in a knowledge aristocracy where only 0.008% of the world's population have access to these scientific journals. And then you have 80% of the world, 5.5 billion people, who just don't have access to information at all. So it's like taking 80 people off the streets of New York and saying, You guys are the only ones who have access to knowledge, and then everyone else, too bad for you. And I think that this is a really dire problem in scientific research, and that people are beginning to realize this. And because imagine if we could live in a knowledge democracy where, regardless of whether you're from Cambodia to China, from Malaysia to Morocco, you'd have the exact same access to knowledge, whether you're a billionaire or living on less than a dollar a day, because science shouldn't be a luxury and knowledge shouldn't be a commodity. It should be a basic human right.
That should be quoted right there. That's amazing. So what is this, Fair Access to Science and Technology Act? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
And how can we support it?
So how you can support it is calling your representatives about and talking to them about it, or looking at the Right to Research Coalition, just getting informed about the issue, really.
Right to Research. Now you were honored by the White House for Science and Technology as a champion of change and open science. And I can see why. You are listening to the People Speak Radio on BBS. Next, we're going to talk to Jane Andreka, Jack's mother.
Got questions? The library has got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBS
Radio.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the world.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
This is The People Speak on BBS Radio. We're welcoming Jane Andreka, which is Jack's mother, to the show, and she's going to share with us some of the ways that we can be better mothers and future mothers. So welcome to the show, Jane. Thank you for coming.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So please tell us, what did you learn in your 18 years as a mother?
Well, you know, my parents raised me like I was a plant. They figured if they just feed me, give me some water, well, then I'd grow up. And, you know, I always wondered if that was the way to get the best out of the child. And so I thought I would take parenting a bit more seriously and not just survival, and just see what I could do to help them become all they could be. And in my journey, I did learn some things, and that is not to always depend on other people to do everything for you, maybe to think for yourself. And so I thought to myself, what would my kids like to be great at? And then I stepped back and I said, well, why is it all me trying to put myself on my kids? Maybe I should discover and help them discover what they're good at, and then help them become the best at whatever they decided to be as best I could. And so that was my whole reason for parenting this way, was to help my kids decide what they're good at and then help them become that. And in this journey, I did learn a lot. I learned that sometimes experts, you know, like teachers and principals, they might have a different agenda than you do. So their agenda might be to have the kids pass the highest test in America, the Advanced Placement Test, to have as many kids take the Advanced Placement Test and do real well, and have all their kids, you know, get great grade points and great standardized tests. But, you know, sometimes in this new modern economy, that might not be enough. Maybe a lot of kids are, you know, doing rote memorization. Maybe a lot of kids can just sit and study and just absorb the information and spit it back for a test. But what if we have to prepare our kids for a world where you might not send out a resume, where you just have to create your own job? What then? And then it's important for the kid to learn how to find out what's important to him or her and how to achieve that themselves. Instead of training kids or even teaching them, that maybe a parent could mentor their kid and help them discover their own path in life. And that was my whole, you know, way of doing this. And because I didn't really have any training, you can't really be trained to be a parent, I just spent a lot of time thinking and really experimenting with this. So first, how do you know when you're a kid what you're good at? And so my idea was just to try as many things as possible, because when you become good at something, then you like it more. And when you like it more, you'll try it more and you'll work harder. So the whole thing is to find where that intersection of what you're good at and what you really love come together, and then you're unstoppable. But for a long time, there was a lot of stops. There were a lot of mistakes, a lot of setbacks. And, you know, so we tried every sport in America, like football is king. So the kids tried football and they really were not good at it. And they really had no talent. So really, the harder they worked, it wasn't going to help them. They, you know, you have to have some sort of special physicality for football. So we tried soccer and lacrosse and basketball and just every sport. And there was a lot, some broken bones, some casts, and they just decided, you know, maybe I really don't want to spend the 8 hours I have outside of school doing this. And that's fine. Other kids, you know, they live for these sports. But, you know, if your kid isn't one of them, then you need to move on. So I thought, okay, no more broken bones. We're going to try musical instruments, because surely, you know, musical instruments, there's got to be one for everybody. So there was long, painful years of piano and, let me see, every stringed instrument, violin and cello and I can't even remember them all, and flute and the recorder, and I can't, it just goes on and on, saxophone and the, what's that thing, the licorice stick, I don't know, some other instrument. Anyway, on and on we went, and although they could tootle along and they practiced, because I wouldn't let them give up for at least a year on an instrument before they could start another instrument, there were so many tears, and it became rather clear quickly to both to their teachers, you know, and me, the audience that they really didn't have a whole lot of musical talent either, nor did they enjoy it enough because, you know, just because you're not good, it's, you know, it's okay to keep going if you like it, but they really didn't like it either. So we kept working on stuff, and I thought, well, math, Jack would love math, and math he really took to, and I thought, this is where his intersection of ability and interest will coincide. He'll be amazing at it. And he really started to progress. He did summer classes in it. He did winter classes. He took extra classes. And it just seemed like that was the way it was going to go until he discovered science fairs when he was in sixth grade. And all along, I had sort of taught him the rudiments of the scientific method, just so that he'd leave me alone a bit and quit asking so many questions. But then when he was in middle school, he started doing science fair. And just having it mean more to him personally, because, you know, when you're in middle school, you're 12, you're 13, and that's when your peer group is very important and you want to excel in some way. And of course, sports and music were out of the question, and math didn't get a huge, you know, groupie following that at least the science fair, it was real popular in his school. And it was sort of the gem of the year. It was the standout, you know, activity that they were going to do. And he put a lot of time, his heart and his soul into it, and he would do well. And of course, when you do well and it wasn't that hard, well, then you want to do it again. And it was really interesting. And so you start thinking and reading. And so he would do well every year. And of course, he wanted to do better every year and really step up his projects. And how exciting was that, you know? But I also felt, wow, you're really sort of overstepping your boundaries here. You're getting a little bit too ahead of yourself. But, you know, that breeds resilience and persistence.
So you had to reel him in sometimes.
I tried to, but you know, when somebody has the bit in their teeth and they're really excited and they're learning and they're an unstoppable, well, then that's a great moment, because then as a parent, you can step back and just let all that persistence and resilience they've learned to just take over. And so that's pretty exciting. And so then he decided to do this science fair project, you know, with the cancer. And so I really felt like that was too much for him, that he shouldn't do it. But he really persisted, and he tried to get us to do it. And we were like, oh man, you know, you're 14. This is just too much for you. But he convinced us that he was going to give it a try, even though it might have been easier to do a different project. And, you know, just because of the lessons that he had learned through doing science experiments and through being rejected so much, he was able to, you know, pursue his dream. And actually, totally unexpectedly, make it work. How cool is that? So that's some things that I learned through all of this, was that you need to train your kids early to hunt for themselves. Because, as I said, just like a lioness out on the savanna doesn't just turn her cubs loose and tell them, well, go on, go find some meat, she helps them learn. And that's where parents can have a lot of ability to help change their kids' lives. So many of my friends say, oh, well, they will do it. They will teach your kids, and they meaning the teachers or the principals or some coach. But, you know, sometimes you have to reflect and say, well, maybe they aren't able or interested or have all the energy to teach every single kid or mentor every single kid. And who cares more about their kids than a parent? And so I always say, you personally as a parent, take charge of your kids' education and help mentor them. So just like a lioness, as I said, isn't going to just tell her cubs to go hunt, they can watch her hunt. So you can watch your parent surf the internet. You can watch them go to Google, and then you can show them, you know, teach them how to type some keyboarding skills. Then you can say when they have a question, well, let's go look it up on Google. And then they can, you know, learn how to put in those keywords, because having the right keywords is not, you know, intuitive. You need to learn which keywords to put in. You need to learn the persistence and the resilience of not getting the answers that you want. You need to, you know, have your parent there going, awesome, good job. What do you do next? And just sort of extend their abilities little by little. And then when it comes time to write those science papers, don't expect the teacher to, you know, provide all of the necessary information. Let the kids now search it out. Let them figure out how to put it out in a very understandable form. And then, you know, you can kindly suggest some ways to improve. And that way the kid takes ownership of his own learning. The kid just isn't memorizing stuff and spitting it back. They're learning stuff and they're thinking, and they have the tools that you've given them, so they can go out and hunt information for themselves, and they can bounce ideas off of you. And then maybe through the internet, they can meet amazing professors and people interested in the subject. And with the email now and all of, you know, the modern technology, Skype, it's really easy to connect to other people having big ideas and really, you know, make your ideas happen. And so that is my big advice for parents, not only to find that intersection, to help your child find that intersection themselves, but then to help them discover and learn and improve, not to get the grades, not to get the, you know, the position in college that you wish they would have, but just so they could be lifelong learners, and that they could have confidence in themselves and learn resilience and persistence and learn what they really like. And then when they come to something that they really, really like, well, they'll have all the tools right there. They'll know how to make it happen for themselves. And they won't be worried when they fail. They'll be like, ah, that didn't work. Let's try something different.
Oh, amazing. You know, you have so much to teach. And I am so grateful that you took the time to let us know all this information. So as far as a review, let's say we're going to expose them to many things, right? Don't give right. them the answers.
Yes. And less rules, more independent thinking. You know, the person doing the work is the person learning. So you need to bring them up enough that they can start guiding their own learning. You know, and so much learning takes place outside of school is my big thing. Like, school will teach you what the government thinks that you should know, but you have another 8 hours then to learn what you'd like to learn.
You know, so many people just use the TV as their babysitter and that's it. And then with so many fears of you know, a child on the internet, they also limit their child too, you know, by just saying, okay, you can't be on the internet. I can't be watching you.
Yes. So then, you know, they have these things where they keep you from, you can, you know, monitor your kid where they go online. And that's an important thing to do, to discuss, you know, the rights and privileges of being on the internet, so that you, you know, your kid has a framework of your particular family's beliefs and where they should go and what they should be doing and how much time they should be on it. Just like TV, you know, you wouldn't just let your child turn on any program they want and not discuss it. You might want to discuss what channels are appropriate and how much time you would be on it. So, yeah, you know, and if they're progressing and not just, you know, playing Penguin Club, which is okay to play a little Penguin Club on the internet, but, you know, then what have you been doing? Have you been learning anything? What have you been learning? You got a new project? Show me what you've been doing. You have to actually be involved in your kids' day-to-day life, because really, why have them if you're not going to, you know, enjoy what they're doing and get excited about their progress and help give them some framework for growing up.
Like making the most out of each, all this time or each moment. You know, some people just have such little time. They only get together just at the dinner table.
And that's great, because then you can say, so instead of like what you did at school, which is interesting, but you know that pretty soon they'll go nothing. But when you say, so what project have you been working on? What have you been looking at yourself today? You know, not what teachers have been getting you to do, but what have you been interested in today? Then that gives an expectation of, well, maybe I should be, you know, thinking of something. Maybe I would like to have something to discuss around the dinner table. And even if you're not real interested in, like me, I hate electronics, but I'm actually learning to build, you know, LED cubes and code them just because of my kids' interests. So you can get a lot, you know, it's a two-way street.
Well, I thank you so much. Is there anything else you want to share with us? I mean, I know you had, okay, while Jack was growing up, what was the age and what kind of, he was saying that he was doing Mentos, they were throwing Mentos. And
yeah, that's like a classic baby science fair project where you just put Coke and Mentos together and it explodes, you know, and you can find all this on YouTube. And that's the fun, is there's so many great science projects on the internet that a kid can do, you know, and they have a lot of fun doing it. Especially when they're kids and they have those ones that are violent, you know,
the explosions.
Yeah, they love that.
So he was taking over your kitchen at one time?
Yes, he did take over my kitchen when he was growing some bacteria, and then he put different, I don't know, contaminants on it. And then he'd take a series of pictures over many, many hours and show how the bacteria would die off or not, depending on what was applied to it. So that did take over my kitchen for a really long time. And so that way, when he was ready to do his cancer experiment, I'm like, you know what? This kitchen has been through a lot, and cancer research has no place in my kitchen. You have to go find a lab.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Jane. And I look forward to any future interviews, seeing you out there, because I am absolutely a fan.
Awesome.
Yes, I am absolutely a fan of yours. I would like to thank both Jack Andreka and his mother, Jane Andreka, for taking time to come on the show. Now it is time for audience members to have the opportunity to ask our guest questions. Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate you guys. And we will be having an after show questions. Thank you for joining us tonight. We really do appreciate you. And we're looking forward to a little after show where you'll have questions and answers directly with us here on the People Speak Radio Show. And we have to thank BBS Radio. BBS Radio, I don't know where we'd be without you, for reaching all of these houses, all of these homes, and so many other good guests. We're going to go straight to the questions. And thank you very much, BBS.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.